Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jordan Brown. He's an activist, artist, musician, and award-winning independent filmmaker whose work broadly looks at the social, political, and environmental implications of digital technologies. He's particularly interested in cultivating a critical view of today's culture of screens and has recently completed a feature-length documentary on the subject called Staring to the Lights, My Pretties. So first off, thank you for your fabulous work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks, Derek. Thank you for your work as well. It's really great, and thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So tell me and tell the audience about the new film, Staring to the Lights, My Pretties.
Okay, well, yeah, I've recently completed my first feature-length documentary. It's a film that takes a critical view of today's sort of culture of screens, how we're just completely immersed in this society and culture that's just completely dependent on digital technologies. And it's a polemical film, so it's something that I want to use as a sort of catalyst to open up some bigger questions about this culture's reliance on technology, but also how the technology influences people, society, and the environment. So it's sort of this tiered interplay, I suppose.
Well, before we go any further, can you define, what do you mean by culture of screens? Does that include television then? What are you saying?
Well, yeah, there's a voice in the film, Susan Greenfield. She's a renowned neuroscientist from the UK. And she defines this brilliantly in the film, in that what she means by screen culture, and I guess is what I've taken to expand in the film, is that screen culture is defined as it's not so much the devices themselves. Well, it is that, but it's more so the amount of time we spend with screens, and how screens are sort of everywhere. So yeah, she includes things like the amount of time people spend in front of a laptop or with their mobile phones, and with sort of emerging technologies like Google Glass, things like this. So it's more specifically, what am I trying to say here? She talks about screen culture as being this sort of pervasive phenomenon that has big implications on the brain, and she talks about that from a neuroscience perspective.
So what are you've said sort of the person, society, and the environment. So what are some of the personal implications for devoting, or let's back up even before that. So when we talk about screen time, do you have any numbers? Do we know, like, how much time people spend on screens today versus how much time they did? Let's go with a background of 200 years ago, they spent zero. 80 years ago, they spent some, but not as much. And then do you know, like, how much time do people spend on screens?
Well, I know today, and some of these figures are fairly old. I think a stat that I have from 2010, I think it is from memory, is that it's something in the vicinity of 10 hours a day, and that's sort of the average amount of time that an adult would spend in front of a screen. Perhaps that figure would be much larger for younger people these days, but I think, it's somewhere around that area, sort of. There are varying numbers, but I think probably more conservative one would be, yeah, anywhere between 6 to 10, maybe even 12 hours a day in front of a screen.
Which is the majority of our waking hours.
Yeah. It's probably one of the things we spend most of our time doing, interacting with some kind of digital technology in one way or another.
And what are some of the... Sorry, go ahead.
No,
go ahead, please.
I wasn't going to say anything further.
What are some of the psychological and neurophysical and other psychological effects of this? Because that has to have some effects.
Okay, well, I guess one place we could start with this would be just the way that it physically changes the brain. And again, Susan Greenfield, the neuroscientist in the film, talks about this from sort of a very, even just on a very scientific basis. There's this notion in neuroscience called neuroplasticity, which is this way to... neuroplasticity is the phenomenon of how your brain physically changes. The connections in your brain physically are influenced by your experience, the way you perceive and understand the world. So,
a classic example of this, by the way, is that they've done brain scans of London taxi drivers, and London's supposed to be one of the hardest cities in the world to change. I mean, I'm sorry, one of the hardest cities to get around. And London taxi drivers then learning all those streets affects their brain physically.
Yeah, that's a really great example. So, and I guess it's analogous to doing a physical exercise. So if you're using, say, if you're using your arms, and your muscles develop. But if, and the same hand, if you're not using your muscles, they atrophy, and you lose that capability. It's the same thing in the brain. If you're rehearsing a certain set of skills or having a certain sort of reaction or experience, then that develops and sustains the sort of brain connections, the neuro connections in your brain, and that strengthens those connections, which makes it easier for your brain to sort of for those pathways in the brain to sort of to interact and with each other. So yeah, if we're spending the majority of our time sitting in front of a screen, we get really good at using a screen, but we also change our brains more into this sort of notion of becoming a computer itself. We become really used to being bombarded by lots of information. It brings up issues such as distraction. And because, you know, a lot of the online environment is designed, I would say, but has very obvious elements of distraction. I mean, we can talk about stuff like advertising that's constantly bombarding you when you're online, or just even the notion of when you're trying to do something online, just say you're writing someone back, writing an email or something, or you're looking up something on Google to satisfy one of your random curiosities that you may have at any point in the day, most likely you're interrupted. You're interrupted with a ping of something. You know, maybe your phone goes off, or maybe you get an email, or you get a Facebook message or something like this. So distraction is a big part of the environment and the online environment. And so I guess one of the things from a neuroscience perspective is that if you're practicing being distracted, then that's what you're going to do. You're going to not only become used to being distracted, but it will become a much stronger part of your experience. And I guess it exacerbates and encourages that kind of thinking, that kind of scatterbrain thinking, where you're jumping from one thing to the next all the time. You're not sort of going deep with anything, which means that you're not practicing and using the ability to think about things linearly or really go deep on anything, because you're constantly being distracted and jumping around. So I mean that would have, like, I imagine that has very concerning personal implications, like implications at a personal level, but also, we can take it on from there. If we have large groups of people that are sort of have short attention spans and are very used to being distracted, then surely that has very concerning social implications as well.
Yeah, I interviewed someone else about how long-form thinking is becoming rarer, and then the relationship between an incapacity to do long-form thinking and an incapacity to solve some of the most difficult personal and social questions facing us today.
Well, I think that's something really classic. That's like long-form thinking is probably the first thing we see being lost to the screens. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, even in terms of news reporting, how we've seen this. I mean, we can talk about the sort of the collapse of journalism and the crisis of mainstream media. That's a whole other conversation. But I think even just the notion that, news is sort of being reported in short snippets these days. We have this sort of news culture that, you know, institutions want to break the story in real time. And so instead of this analysis, we just have this rolling, constant sort of flood of tweets or little snippets of information without much context or without much analysis. We just get sort of bombarded by this tsunami of information that doesn't really connect to anything. We don't have time to sort of critically analyze anything, or again, we don't get this opportunity give ourselves the opportunity to go deep with any information because we're just being bombarded. So yeah, we're really losing this ability to be doing, yeah, long form thinking and going deep on an idea and sitting with it and being contemplative, I think.
And I watched your film and I sent you a note about this, and I was only going to watch like the first 5 or 10 minutes, and I ended up watching the whole thing in one sitting and just thought it was absolutely fabulous. And
well, thank you.
One of the people in there mentions the effects of screens on our memories, that we're seeing already a decrease in the capacity to remember, because why should you remember when you can just type it into Google?
Yeah. Yeah, this was, I can't remember her name now. That's horrible. I think Sparrow is her last name. Maybe it's Pat Sparrow. I'm sorry if I have that wrong, but Sparrow is definitely her last name. She did a study that was talking about how, if the people you give them information that they not expected to remember later, then they don't remember that information as well. And she talks about this phenomenon where people, instead of remembering the information itself, they recall the place to find it, which is essentially Google these days. So people, she was talking about the way how people would think about Google first, or would think about their computer first when they're trying to recall information, or where they're seeking to find an answer for something. And yeah, this sort of plugs into the larger question of what are we doing as a culture when we're not, when that's the first thing we think of. We think about the place to find it, when we're confronted with a question or something we don't know.
And there is also the question of giving up tremendous power to that single source of information when instead of relying on either your own memory. I mean, basically, we have outsourced memory to Google.
Yeah. I think this is really where the film began for me. The germ of the film's idea was, I had this idea back in 2009 that I was going to, because I could see it emerging then already, and perhaps it was a new journey for me, but I had this idea that maybe I would make a film using Google as a case study to sort of talk about the way that one company is having such a tremendous influence over many aspects of our life. And of course, at that stage, Google just started scanning a bunch of out of print books and sort of making this sort of large digital repository of books that was just for themselves. And so one of the concerns I have and had back then is, yeah, what does it mean when one company privatizes the world's information and uses it sort of in a monopolistic fashion? And of course, you know, I went off to interview and do things like this and started developing a film, but really got bowled over by the fact that it's not just one company. It's not just one technology either. I mean, one of the other voices in the film, Katina Michael, which is one of the first interviews that I had, sort of broke out into this larger discussion of this culture's complete fascination with things like artificial intelligence and robotics. So I think I realized pretty early on that it's not just one company, it's not just Google, and it's not just one technology, it's not just the internet, or it's not just computers. I think it's this sort of larger question of the implications of digital technology in general. So, but yeah, that's where the film really started, I suppose, was from the question of, yeah, what does it mean on a personal and societal level if one company has such extensive influence over the information streams that we're all really tethered to?
Speaking of one company, suddenly I remembered the Lord of the Rings line about one ring to rule them all.
Right.
So speaking of one company influencing people on a pretty profound scale, you have one of the parts of the film that I thought was really, really important. The whole thing is important, but one that was just blew me away was the bit about Facebook. And
mm-hmm.
Facebook is, there was a line, I'm going to throw the line out, and then if you can fill in behind and in front of this line, the line was about how, something along the lines of, we think that Facebook is helping little Johnny to make friends, but what Facebook is really about is predicting your future, is knowing you so well that they can predict your future wants and get you to pay for them. So can you...
Yeah.
Can you fill in around that? That line was just so brilliant.
Yeah, well, the line was, that was by Douglas Rushkoff. I think he was talking about, he's basically saying that, well, you've got it right, essentially. He was saying that, he's talking about the myth. He's talking about the way, how there's not really this deep understanding about what the tools we're using are for. So we sort of have this myth that is espoused by a bunch of companies, and all the online companies do this. They have these sort of slogans and these big sort of philanthropic ideas and aims. You know, Google presents itself as being this sort of champion of openness, but what they really exist for is develop really detailed profiles about you so they can sell you ads. That's their whole business. And Facebook is the same. Facebook isn't so much a place to make friends. I mean, that's sort of where it came from, but it's one of the primary purposes of itself as a business is to commodify your social relationships. And so what Douglas Rushkoff is talking about there is that today we don't even know what the tools we're using it for. You know, you ask a regular young user of Facebook, you know, what do you think Facebook is for? Oh, it's there to help me make friends. But you go to the boardroom of Facebook, and what are they talking about there? Are they talking about how can we make little Johnny make more friends? You know, how can we foster deeper, meaningful human relationships? No, they're not talking about that at all. They're talking about how are we going to monetize Johnny's social graph and how are we going to use that data to mine it and look for patterns in order to sell Johnny's future to himself before he knows he's there himself. So, yeah, but I think that idea is talking about something quite large, which I think is very concerning about lots of these digital tools, is that they're very manipulative, and they're manipulative by design. And I think it's even a little bit sinister in a way, in that there's this sort of pretense that the tools are designed for this purpose, and maybe they are in some cases, but I think there's a very strong ancillary purpose, which is to make money and sell advertising, which also opens up this sort of great door for surveillance and manipulation and social control and these ideas, these are the ideas that are sort of explored in the film, I suppose, yeah.
So just let's be explicit about this. How does Google or Facebook monetize our desires or monetize our interests or monetize our... How exactly do they make money?
Well, in a few ways. I mean, say something with... Google does this a bunch of ways, but one of the primary ways is that every time you search for something on Google, or every time you visit a web page, and there's many web pages out there online that use Google services, such as if you visit a website that has a Google ad on it, that's talking to Google servers, and that's information that Google then brings in to develop a profile they're just amassing vast amounts of data about what they're guessing are people. And I guess they just wait and keep collecting information until the point where they can guess with pretty good probability that they're really talking to you. They're talking to the other person on the other end of this screen. So one of the ways they make money is by using that information to sell you products, to show you targeted advertising. Advertising is essentially Google's primary business model. The same is true for Facebook. I mean, Facebook is all about bringing you into this digital space that where everyone else is. Everyone's having their conversations there, and people are doing their socializing and their... I mean, they call it the social network, after all, which has this sort of effect. As more people join Facebook, it becomes more valuable to join because everyone else is there. They call it the network effect, which is the same thing that happened with the telephone. I mean, the telephone wasn't really useful until everyone had a telephone, which made it more, which made the sort of appeal of it, I guess, to get a telephone stronger. And there's social influence on that too. Sort of, I guess peer pressure is not the right phrase, but there's social pressures that come from an example like that. But anyway, yeah, Facebook operates in the same way in that they're really gathering all of these really detailed information streams. They're doing this vast data gathering for the purposes of advertising. And then not only that, with a company like Facebook, they're also selling the data sets that they have, as far as I know, or there are other companies out there that buy information from companies like Facebook to amass detailed demographic profiles, and I think they call it like psychoanalytics these days. So there's a bunch of companies out there that are in the business of, I guess, essentially spying on people, and one of the guy that invented the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, recently spoke about this publicly a few years ago, saying that the internet is now the world's largest surveillance network, which is basically run on targeted advertising for the purposes of advertising. So there are a whole bunch of companies out there on the web that exist to profile people, to really learn what they're doing, learn about their interests, learn about where they are in physical space, because we're all essentially walking around with mobile phones in our pockets that are essentially tracking devices that just happen to make phone calls. So we have all of these companies out there that are in the business of vacuuming up all of these digital data trails and then using them for a bunch of purposes, but one of them that's really pervasive is, yeah, selling people in a really, giving people advertising to sell them stuff in a really targeted and targeted and granulated way that's really specific to them, that can capture, you know, your own unique personal characteristics, if you know what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, you know, the whole time I was watching your film, and again in this conversation, I kept thinking about how I started my book, Welcome to the Machine. And the way I started it was, that when I was a kid, I was a Christian, and I'm talking 7, 8, 6, you know, in that area. We were told that, you know, God knows your thoughts and God knows everything about you. And that's okay because God loves you. It's okay. But the devil can't read your thoughts, but the devil can watch you all the time. And even when I'm 6, 7, and 8, I realized that if you can watch someone's every action, you can effectively know their thoughts. It came very clear to me that even in this construct, effectively, and of course I couldn't use this language at 7 years old, but I understood the concept that if you can surveil someone at every moment and know that they move from here to here and know the expressions on their face from selfies, whatever, you know, if you can know a person's external actions and you get enough data, that's the real point. If you can collect enough data on a person, you can begin to effectively predict that person's thinking.
Yeah.
And a small example that's true for my dog is that when I used to leave the house, I mean, I still leave the house, but I had this one dog that every time I left the house, he would get up and walk with me if we went for a walk. But if I went to the car, he would not even get up from the porch. He'd just sit there. And it took me a couple of years to figure out it's because if I was holding car keys in my hand, he knew I was getting in the car and not to bother to get up. And my point is, if you see somebody with car keys in their hand, you can predict they're going to get in a car. And that's just a really trivial thing. If you can, you know, if somebody is always looking up some specific thing, if somebody is constantly looking up critics of screen culture, one can begin to surmise that that person is thinking negative thoughts about screen culture. I mean, this whole thing is just a long-winded way of saying that total surveillance means that you can effectively predict someone's actions. That's the whole point.
Yeah, and I would say that's the something that has been purposefully designed in some of these technologies. The whole purpose is to encourage disclosure. I mean, and one of the things we see a lot that happens in a lot of online platforms, but particularly Facebook, is that they want to encourage you to disclose. The whole purpose of the technology is to play to certain psychological characteristics, so you are disclosing all the time. And even in other ways, in some ways that you're not even doing directly. I've heard of instances where, say, you take a picture on a device such as an iPhone that has a whole bunch of other data embedded into it that you may not even realize that. I mean, you're just taking a photo of something somewhere, but, you know, the GPS coordinates are embedded into the photo, and once you upload that information onto the internet, that information can be extracted and possibly added to your profile. So I think it's sort of been baked into the way these technologies are designed and deployed in the world, is that they're pushing for as much disclosure from us as possible to come to this point where, yeah, I mean, I would argue, and as you mentioned in your book, The Welcome to the Machine, that this is a panopticon. The way the technology functions is similar or analogous to what a panopticon is.
And people may not know what that is, so can you tell us?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think you've mentioned before, probably in a much better way, maybe I can paraphrase you, is that, I think the panopticon was developed by Jeremy Bentham, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, and so his design, it's basically a prism design. And the purpose of, so you design a prism in a circle, and you have the guard tower in the center and all of the prison cells around the outside that face the center, and the tower in the center is where the people that run the prison are, the people that are looking at all of the cells. I don't know what they're called, like, what do you call them, people that run the prison?
Guards.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Guards.
Yeah, the guards. So the guards are in the center tower, and the prisoners are all around the outside. The guard tower is really bright. The lights come from there, so the guard tower can see into all of the cells of the prisons around, in the circle. So there's nowhere to hide. There's no sort of interstices of the prison to sort of hide in. But the other effect of this is that, if you're a prisoner, you don't know at any, you can't see the guard, you can't see in the center because it's bright, you may not even know where the center is. But the other part of this is that you also don't know when you're being watched, and that you can be watched at any given time and you don't know when that is. So there's this sort of chilling effect, on your behavior that is central to social control, central to controlling people's behavior. If you don't know when you're going to be observed, you're going to change your behavior because you could be observed at any time. So it's sort of this neat way to have control over people.
Earlier, you mentioned how phones had to get a sort of critical mass before they were, I think you called it the networking effect. And it reminded me of how I've read some accounts of when telephones were introduced, there were a lot of people who thought they were incredibly intrusive. Carl Jung, for example, did not like them, and felt that they interrupted your capacity to have contemplative time. And it just makes me think about how so often technologies are, at first there can be a discussion of the harmful effects of them, but then that discussion is swept away and they are presented to us as a form of convenience or a form of utility, and then somewhere along the line they become an absolute necessity. By now I'm one of the few people I know who does not carry a cell phone with me everywhere I go. And I mean, I hate getting phone calls already. And so when it's like the notion of actually carrying a phone with me when I'm walking through the forest or running errands or doing something else is just horrifying. But I'm a dinosaur and I recognize that. And I'm just thinking about this process. I mean, I love the line you said a while ago about how we're basically carrying around surveillance devices that happen to be useful as phones and the tracking devices. And so can you talk a little bit about, and I keep thinking also, I'm sorry to go on, but I keep thinking also about one of the Doobie Brothers albums, which was called What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits. And I'm thinking about how what were once scary is now accepted. You know, GMOs are the same way. There was this big discussion, GMOs are going to be really scary. And then at some point, it went from, well, we need to think about it, to, oh, here they are, they're in your food, and by the way, you don't even get to know if they're in your food. So I don't know what I'm getting at. Can you pull any question out of this little rant that I just did?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things there. There's a few ways to go. I suppose one of the things I want to, I guess, would be say first is that, I mean, I haven't had a phone for 7 years. I gave up a mobile phone, a long time ago just because I went without it for a period of time and I really liked it. And that was 7 years ago. And I think things have changed a lot since then. And even then, like I've noticed the way that really has changed a bunch of my social interactions. I mean, you meet a new person for the first time or, you know, someone wants to get in contact with you. What's your mobile number or how can I find you on Facebook? And I think there's sort of this weird thing that happens when you're telling people, oh yeah, I'm not on Facebook or I don't have a phone or something. It's almost seen as this, you know, who is this person? Why aren't they sort of part of this grand sort of digital world? It sort of raises this weird air with people. So there's that. That's the first thing. But I think there really is this sort of, and this is something I try and explore just a little in the film, but I think it's a fairly big topic in and of itself and could probably, and I hope the film sort of is a catalyst to open up this kind of discussion, you've mentioned it happens with a bunch of technologies, not just digital technologies, but especially with digital technologies, I think there's this effect called creeping normalcy, which is the way that slow incremental changes, and perhaps even with digital technology, it's not even that slow. I mean, the pace of technology is so rapid, but what creeping normalcy is that it's this notion that if things change at a slow enough pace, then things become normalized and pass by unnoticed. So, yeah, I mean, the examples that you mentioned are quite good. Something that comes along which would be seen as an objectionable is at the time, this is outrageous, but it slowly becomes normalized and people sort of forget it or let go of it or, you know. And especially with something like technology where if you have even just a question, you're not even critical about technology, you're sort of labeled as a Luddite or, you know, you're backwards or you're an old fuddy-duddy or something like this. There's this really systemic cultural objection to even questioning technology. And there's this great line by Jerry Mander in the film sort of saying there's considerable resistance about the very idea of challenging technology. And even just asking questions of, you know, what are we doing? Or is what we're doing with technology a good thing? And I would ask on a social level is, you know, how technology influenced what society means and how society functions and the implications on society. Is all of that, you know, what are the negative effects of that? So, yeah, there's this very strong opposition to even asking the question, which I think is problematic. We need to break through that. We need to really seriously consider what is happening. Actually, I just saw something in the news today. Let me see if I can remember this guy's name. But he was a former Facebook executive. What was his name? Chamath Palihapitiya. So he was Chamath Palihapitiya. Yeah, he was a former Facebook executive that recently came out sort of saying that he feels tremendous guilt about how he contributed. His job at Facebook at the time was trying to encourage user growth and get more people on the platform in 2007. And I think in November this year, he's come out saying that what does he say? So here's his quote, yeah. Quote, "The short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we've created are destroying how society works. There's no civil discourse, there's no cooperation, we have misinformation, mistruth, and it's not an American problem. This is not about Russian ads. This is a global problem." And so, yeah, I mean, I think possibly this is a good time for this film to be coming out. I think we even have sort of former executives and technologists themselves sort of being like, you know, oh shit, what have we created? I think I read something not long ago either too by someone who was working on the iPad or the iPhone or something like this, saying that he had sleepless nights of thinking about how, you know, I think he might have children himself, sort of being really confronted by the fact that, you know, lots of young people are completely addicted to their phones and there's a whole bunch of negative effects there to deal with addiction. There's stories in, say, South Korea where people are dying in internet cafes just because they're playing online games for, you know, hours and hours on end with not drinking water and not going to the toilet, and they're just dying. And actually, there was one famous case in South Korea in which it has a very sort of sad irony to it. There was a couple that had a daughter in real life, and the couple was, they were a young couple, completely addicted to playing this online game. And in the online game, the purpose of the game was to skill up play the game with this little avatar of a girl. And they were so addicted to this game that their real life daughter died of malnutrition. They would sort of sneak out at night and leave the baby at home and play this game for days on end. And the real world baby, the baby in the real world, their own daughter died from malnutrition and complete neglect. And they were just completely, addicted to this online game. So, yeah. I think I sort of ventured off the question there.
No, absolutely. That's right on. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and
wow.
The first you hit one subject that I really wanted to hit, and I'm wondering if you can, but leave enough time to do another question. And the question has to do with, you said dopamine driven, and you mentioned the word addicted, and that was another mm-hmm. part of the film I thought was absolutely brilliant, was where you talked about the addictiveness of screen culture. Can you talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that, like how you get a little hit of dopamine every time you see that somebody liked your comment?
Yeah, well, that's essentially it. It's the same thing. There's a chapter in there about how there's been a lot of research done on what drives gambling, you know, what makes gambling so enticing. And there's a behaviorist towards the end of the film that talks about this. That's really, it's from a different era, I suppose. He wrote a book in the 60s sort of talking about, just ways that you can encourage and exacerbate different forms of behavior modification. And one of the analogies that I tried to make there was, that the design of the technologies is similar in playing a slot machine or something like this, because a slot machine is built on this, you don't know when you're going to get this exciting and enticing reward. So you're playing the slot machine constantly looking to get that little hit. It's the same thing or it's analogous to the online experience where, you know, you check your phone and one of the first things a lot of us do when we wake up is we check our phone. You know, what do you get? Sometimes you get an exciting new TED talk, or, you know, you get an email from the girl you're trying to date or something like this. And other times you get nothing. You just get junk or spam. So it's a similar kind of phenomenon in the brain, in which you don't know when you're going to get that exciting, enticing reward. And that's what drives the addiction. That's what drives they call it stickiness drivers, I think, like the notion that how can we make our product so enticing that people keep coming back? This is something that the technologists, they employ like teams of psychologists to tweak very specific things about not only their programs, but the experience of the programs to make them completely enticing and to keep people coming back. I mean, this is an old idea with advertising. It goes way back, you know, to the early days of advertising, where it's, you know, which colors do people respond to the most, and which media vehicle do we execute certain advertising messages in to get people to do certain things. But I think the difference now is that with digital technology, these insights are so much more valuable to psychologists and the advertisers and the people that are working on marketing messages, is because they know the ways that which we will react best. They know how to push our buttons, because we've disclosed so much about ourselves that possibly, and in some ways, they can know us better than we know ourselves almost. So, yeah, I mean, there's huge implications there. It's deeply problematic.
So one of the things I love about your work is, okay, my next question is going to be, so what do we do about this? And one of the things I love about your work is that, you know, you did, after all, do my essay, Forget Shorter Showers, into another great film, that I know that your sole solution to this is not going to be, well, turn it off and step outside, because that might work for you or me, but that doesn't actually solve the social problem. So mm-hmm. having said all this, sorry to paint you in a corner here, but having said all this, what do you want people to do with the information? So somebody watches your film, which again, the name is Stare Into the Light, My Pretties. Somebody watches your film. What do you want them to do with the analysis and information they gain from this?
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing would be there's a bunch of things. One of the things I would hope that would come out of watching the film would be to question our own, to look at ourselves first to see, well, yeah, how am I being influenced by technology, and what does that mean? And then what is my understanding of these technologies, and, you know, how am I being manipulated, or how am I being, you know, what's happening? And then I guess, yeah, the next part of it is like, well, if I think that's a bad thing, then yeah, I mean, we do need to turn off the computers. We do need to sort of walk away from this, but we also need to, I think, really have some solid reflection about many of the larger questions that stem out of this. Is that, yeah, we're starting to look on, I think I would like people to, ask the question of who benefits from this the most. Because I think it's clearly not us. It's the corporations that are completely controlling our online experience and have a really strong grip on our lives. I think that's problematic. And I hope one of the questions that people have after watching this film, and perhaps if they agree with that, is, yeah, how do we tackle these huge corporate interests that have extensive influence over our lives? And one of the things that I would hope would come out of that is basically, yeah, a strong critique of capitalism in that we need to, it's not just about turning off the technologies and walking away, it's about completely rethinking the social system that gives rise to these technologies, and perpetuates them. And changing that and really putting a spanner in the works. So we're talking about, yeah, completely rethinking the social and economic systems that exist in the world. We're talking about completely walking away from capitalism, I suppose, imagining some other world. And I hope that's possible.
Well, it has to be possible. And the thing we haven't really talked about is the environmental implications of digital technologies.
Well, yeah, that's very important.
And, you know, if we can't figure out a way to solve all of this, then there's not going to be a planet. Is there anything else?
Well, that's one of the big things. I think fundamentally, these technologies aren't, I mean, I think it was John Michael Greer wrote a book called The Ecotechnic Future. And I may not have this right, but I have a memory of how he was talking about how the amount of energy that is required to run the internet. And I mean, I guess we could look at this in other ways too, like the energy that goes into developing computers or the rare earth minerals that are required to make computers exist. That's completely not sustainable. But just looking at the internet, the amount of energy that is required to make the internet happen is quite astounding. I think I was reading something before about how at current rates of consumption, by 2020, the web hosting industry will surpass the airline industry in global environmental pollution. So that's quite astounding to think about. You know, the global airline industry, the total output of their pollution will be smaller than what is outputted by the internet by 2020 at current rates of consumption. That ignores growth, which is something that will probably happen quite sooner. In that, you know, there's this complete explosion with sort of digital technologies with the growth. It's just insane. So, yeah, the environmental impacts of technology, I think, is another thing that isn't really considered or spoken about as often as it should be, because, the environmental impacts are horrifying. We could talk about things like what's going on in the Congo for the mining of the rare earth minerals that go into our gaming consoles and the smartphones and the tablets and all of these technologies. There's a complete horror that's happening in that part of the world with the, you know, human rights abuses and the civil war and, you know, warlords and drug running and all of the horrible things that are happening there that are basically driven by companies like Sony and Nokia and Apple and so on. So, yeah, I mean, the environmental implications of digital technology span out in a bunch of ways. It's a huge conversation in and of itself. But, yeah, basically, the end point is that this is not something that can continue indefinitely. There is an end point to this. And it's we need to choose if we're going to have a soft crash and withdraw from the screens in a way that can wake us up to real life again, or if we're just going to stay embedded in these computers, completely distracted, withdrawn from the real world, and have a harsh, brutal reawakening to reality while the real world burns.
Well, I highly recommend that anybody who listens to this, how can people watch your film? That's the last question.
Yeah, well, they can go to my website, which is www.jore.cc, or I guess they can search for Stare Into the Lights, My Pretties. It's on YouTube. You can find it out there. Or the Internet Archive is probably another more interesting place to find this. Support that organization. They seem to be doing good work. It's out there. You can find it. Search for Stare Into the Lights, My Pretties.
Well,
I hope people enjoy it.
I recommend everybody watch it. And I would like to thank you very much for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jordan Brown. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.